Welcome to lunch. Welcome to the aftermath of two enormous pizzas, one of which had jalapeno peppers and the other of which had, what do you call those things? Ham. Parma ham. Look, we've been joined at the table by a man who knows all about this place that we're in. So I'm going to just literally hand the mic to him. We're in the Science Gallery, and he can talk without hesitation, repetition, or deviation. On the topic of the Science Gallery. Ken, will you introduce yourself and talk as much as you like?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Kenneth McKenzie. I've a hybrid existence. I'm a social psychologist by training, and I still work as a social psychologist, and I work as a strategic planner and consumer psychology consultant. For the other side of the house. And what I like, we're meeting here in the Science Gallery, and what I think is very good about the Science Gallery is there was a shift in museums and scientific galleries experience from about the mid-90s onwards, where they tried to make them a lot more interactive. What that generally meant was getting, in my sense, getting rid of cards, just descriptive cards in front of exhibits, and trying to add bells and whistles to things. For me, the end result was a dilution of the experience, and maybe an infantilization of what you're meant to encounter.
But also, what did you say? Infantilization?
Yeah.
I love that. Infantilization of what?
You're meant to encounter. So it becomes a kid's event. Mm. And it doesn't in any way engage as an adult. It's just a day for the kids. What I think Science Gallery has got right is that it doesn't have this false divide between we're here to sell copies or we're here to run a few bells and whistles. It's part of and integrated to Trinity, where you have an active program of science going on that is literally just through two doors here in nanotechnology. So it's used as a lecture space, it's used as a research space. It also has the facilities and the infrastructure to bring in really good speakers. Best one I've seen is James Gleick, who wrote The Information, the history of how we've coded and decoded information. True history.
All about DNA or other stuff? What's that about?
It's actually about signal-to-noise ratios. So the idea of zeros and ones and binary codes and how we've been able to use, how we've actually used things like Morse code. It's basically a history of technology and interacting with information. But technology in the broad sense.
Babbage.
Yeah, like Babbage. Going on from the original computer, the computing machine, and obviously on to Alan Turing and so on, just after the Second World War. What I think is very good about what they've done, so James Gleick talked here, and it's self-funding, so you pay €5 to hear, to be honest, a world leader in thought come and speak. The exhibits change quite a lot. They're backed up by a team of scientists who interact with it and advise what should be done. And in some cases, the really exciting part is people who come to the gallery, their data is captured and used as part of the experiment.
You mean our footprint has been captured here today?
No, you'd have to specify.
We're having lunch. Are we being photographed?
No. If you interact with...
Are you
with
sure?
I'm positive. Yeah.
Can you guarantee me?
One thing I can't guarantee is we're not being recorded.
Okay. But,
for example, there was a psychology experiment some while ago where as you interacted with the exhibits, that requires you to give data. You perform, you test it. And that data set, you then take a quick slice of that data. Instead of having like 15 people in a lab, you might then have 400 people over the space of 2 days who've clicked a button or looked at something and given their judgment to it. So it becomes a naturally occurring experiment. And so that's what I think the Science Gallery has got right.
It's a research centre.
It has a research centre. For some
every
exhibits,
exhibit is
not
research.
Every. I think for some exhibits. So there's one coming up
do
now.
Do the public know which one is a research
Yeah, you're told.
Object? You're told,
I think,
yeah.
I think there's an ethical obligation. So there's one, a colleague of mine, Karen Hand, who's very much into branding. She runs Curly Enterprises. She's doing a PhD on branding. And one of the things she's looking at here is...
sorry, there are two teas.
Oh, the tea is arriving.
Yeah,
yes, please. Wonderful.
Just one tea for me. Okay. This is for you. Jonathan, isn't it this tea as well? Yeah.
Yeah, we're just moving one of the pizza trays away.
As
teas and coffees arrive, we'll have a little pause.
No, he's just saying, yeah.
Hey,
it makes sense.
While we're pausing, do you actually work in the science space or do you work in the social science? Are you at the other end of the campus or are you close?
No, I work in the School of Psychology, which is part of our St. Fiersic. So that's just up in a straight line from here. And I also work in UCD in the School of Public Health.
You work in both Trinity and UCD?
Yeah.
I thought that wasn't possible.
It is because it's not. One position is salaried and one isn't. One's an honorary position. I did my undergrad here and I have a great affinity for Trinity. And I love the place and I love what it's always tried to achieve implicitly. Sometimes explicitly it hasn't said that, but it's always tried to achieve certain things. So I've always loved Trinity. And the best way I found of staying in touch with psychology and being able to find out what's topical and what's new and to get energized from ideas is to make a commitment to teach. So I lecture on the Senior Sophister and Junior Sophister Psychology Program in Trinity, and I research work in UCD, in the School of Public Health.
I'm just too curious. Give me one topic you do lecture on.
I lecture on psychology of voting decisions.
Psychology of voting decisions?
Yeah, so I look at information theory. I make collide, say, information theory about how people process ideas, but then I'll wrap that up and things like socio-demographics or culture and see how the two inform each other almost in a statistical model to get why are people voting this way or why are they not.
And what's your research about?
My research currently at the moment is why do people do the wrong thing when it comes to their health. So maladaptive decision making in healthcare, specifically around diet and self-regulation and self-maintenance around things like diabetes.
Wow, one of my clients in Hang Guides is in bed, if you like, with Roche in South Africa, producing an audio guide to go along with their type 2 diabetes medication.
Great idea.
We'll come back to that another time. Yeah. Carry on about the Science Gallery, though.
So yeah, that's what I think. What the Science Gallery's got right is it's something that I don't come here every week, not far from it, but I periodically check in and say, what are they doing? What do I want? And I'm not a tourist here. I've lived here all my life, more or less. And
you have a Dublin accent.
Yeah, I'm from Dublin. And
which part?
Crumlin. So I think it's good that you get this piece of infrastructure that makes you feel you want to check in with it, which is the opposite of how I think a lot of marketing and branding works, which is let's send the newsletter out to people and we don't know if it's going to be read. This is it. They've built it and I will come. I will check what they're doing. And they've succeeded with me, and I evangelize when I talk to people about here's what it's trying to achieve.
And how do you think they got that right? I mean, is it a combination of the space, the thinking behind the space?
The space, its purpose, and the buzz, the hum. So it's not just somebody who's working in, you know, I work in designing an interactive space. It's, yeah, I'm actually a physicist. Or I'm a computer scientist, and I'm going to advise you on exhibits. And some of my PhD students will be here showing kids and adults how this works. I'll actually get some bright undergrads in as well, and they'll spend 3 hours explaining their ideas to people. So you've got this Newtonian coffee shop, which is what we always should have, where you're discussing, talking, using, and testing, rather than just having I'm meant to passively have it.
Is this a Newtonian coffee shop?
Yeah, it's a modern day analog. Yeah.
Where's the apple going to fall on my head?
Yeah.
Are we going to get a MacBook Pro crashing down to the ground?
Well, no, I like this idea, because it's come back to when coffee shop culture began in the UK. You didn't have this, well, scientists are going to be over here in one corner and you're going to get political commentators in the other. You had bright people sitting around discussing the news of the world. The news of the world. And there were salons, debate parlours, there were ways of thinking about stuff. I like when those places are around. So this is, to me, is what the Café Philo movement in France was never going to be. But it's also what some of the amazing museum spaces that were built in the UK, for example, probably set out to be but didn't really capitalise on.
Where do you rate in the UK as a good place? Where would you...
For interactive experience?
Yeah.
I forget the name of it now. I actually think it's closed, but I love the Museum of Urban Life in Manchester. I thought that was a really good place. It was really well built. I thought Manchester is a quintessential place for understanding how a city is founded and set up. And I thought it was a great idea that they ran it. Other place, Manchester's lot, there's quite a small museum called the People's History Museum, which is almost like a cross between trade union and working class history in one place. It's between Manchester and Salford, probably just on the edge. I think, obviously, the great museums in South Kensington have always... They just have a scale about them that means they can't be touched. Having said that, I don't find the British Museum...
It's the opposite.
I don't find it that stimulating. I don't get a lot of... I don't get a buzz when I walk through it. I get the sense that I should see it. But it doesn't make me want to go. And I think that's what you need. I think it's, I actually wonder how many people would go to museums in a place like London. If you took away the tourist number, how many people are Londoners who go, who aren't just looking for a day with the kids, but actually want to be stimulated?
We were talking about the Book of Kells this morning, and one of the things the guy who was telling us about the Book of Kells told us is that 90% of people who visit the Book of Kells come from outside Ireland.
I'm sure, yeah.
And that means that the number of Irish people, the number of people in Dublin who drop in to see the Book of Kells.
What he also said, which was interesting, is that 90% of the people that come here are local people.
Yes.
So there's the
For the Science Gallery.
Science Gallery.
I think that's because the Science Gallery isn't, it's not written about in Rough Guide yet, or Lonely Planet, so it's not on the website when you need to put your tours together. It's also meant to be, it possibly looked on as being a little bit elitist. I think that's wrong. But generally speaking, you're onto a winner if you've got something old to sell. It sells itself.
But look, here we have, I've just seen a woman walk past with a child in a pushchair, right? And there's only a glass separating me from her. She can see us eating, she can see the food we're having, she can see the clothes we're dressed in. You know, this is a transparent building.
It is, but people just think science is hard. And it's not for them, or it's not going to be entertaining. It might involve quantum mechanics, and they don't want to do it. I think what's interesting is people's quite narrow conception of what science is. Whereas some of the work that I've been able to do with medics or with economists, it's broadened my understanding of what science is. It's made me think of where it situates itself. But I still think, the things that work really well in Irish tourism are things that are old and of history. Kilmainham Jail is a really good experience. It's an amazing experience, actually.
I've never been.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience. Yeah. They do it really well. And it's very low on bells and whistles and very high on passion. And the tour guides are everything. They're very knowledgeable. And they situate it in its time and context. Book of Kells, the Isle of Saints and Scholars, it's stuff like...
Sorry, back to Kilmainham. Do the tour guides dress up as...
No, they don't do that. They don't go in character. Thank you very much.
They don't do the in-character stuff. A pizza arriving. A slim little baby.
Incoming pizza.
I can tell you folks that he's eating mushrooms. He's eating...
It's very healthy.
He's eating onions. They're purple onions. Anyway...
Red onion. Yeah. Even though it's purple. So yeah, I like... Well, that's it. You've got age on your side when you're selling those things. For me, the challenge with some of the Book of Kells would be... How do you... I don't know. It's like what Bill Gates spent money on with the Leonardo da Vinci collection. The codex. How do you make an interactive book? That would be helpful. How do you get heads-up displays, maybe, to make that work? I think that would be good. And also, how do you go into long-room exhibits? At times, it's got to be more just looking at books in a case. No offence to them, I think they're great, but it's... You know, that is a niche audience. If you go once, you'll be like...
In that long room?
You want to know what's on those shelves. I mean, the knowledge is there, but it's not speaking to you.
Well, another a rival to here in a way that's never played its card right, maybe for budget reasons, is Marshall's Library. So, which is...
I never heard of that.
It's amazing. Marshall's Library is the oldest private library on the island, I believe. It was owned by, presumably, Archbishop Marsh, who was Dean Swift's boss. And it's beside Patrick's Cathedral. It's part of Patrick's Cathedral. And Swift would have studied there and worked there. And
can we go and visit?
You can. It's probably only open about 4 hours a day, and not on Mondays and Saturdays for 2 hours.
Is that because of the light, and they want to control the amount of light let into the place in the year because it's a very old building? Is that the reason?
I think it's more for me. They don't have a budget. It's not. I don't even know who funds it really. Does it belong to? I think it belongs to Patrick's Cathedral, so it doesn't have that spillover that you get from we make a name for ourselves. It's a great place to go. It makes you call Liverpool Books again. Really does. Same with the long room. But it's great to have this private library that had a similar idea. Great collections.
It's interesting what you were saying about kind of Ireland being associated with things of old and how maybe the Science Gallery, from a tourist perspective, doesn't fit the mindset in terms of Ireland. But it's interesting how Ireland will develop modern and contemporary spaces that should in the future attract people for different reasons apart from history.
And I think actually again the perfect crossover is Imma in Kilmainham, where you've got a beautiful building,
Irish Museum of Modern Art Imma.
And you've got that in an amazing building, just beautiful, and then you throw in the latest art installations into it, and that works really well.
It's shocking combination of modern art with a historic building. Shocking. I mean, literally disruptive of thinking, isn't it?
That's what Robert Hughes likes, though. That's what he says. Agreed. Art should be in that context. It should collide.
Yeah, that was the word you used earlier, Ryan. I noticed you using it, and collide. Mm. Where does that come from for you, that intellectual base in terms of using the word collision? I love it.
Well, it's about rolling a dice or throwing things together and see what happens when you do that. It's about intellectual experimentation and adventure.
Who did it? Who's the intellectual precursor, theorist, grand theorist of colliding as a way of learning?
I think it's a way that has again always been done implicitly by good thinkers. They've always been able to yoke things together. Analogical problem solving is based on collisions. So the way that we reason from one example and then see if it generalizes to a different domain. That's by analogy. So it's an amazingly explanatory tool that we have at our fingertips. And we use it implicitly every day. One thing is very helpful when you're in a university system is how do you structure your thinking so you're able to equip people to do that more systematically than they would otherwise be able to do. And so I'm very interested in how you have... So
you practice the art of colliding with your students all the time?
You can be disciplined for that, I'd say.
Sign up for this course, you know? I guarantee we'll have a collision.
Well, I think my own kind of drum that I bang is it's when I've talked about a lot with a colleague and a good friend of mine who's now in Stirling in Scotland. And it's the idea of an integrated social science. But actually, the common problems they're trying to solve of healthcare decisions, pensions, climate change, democratic legitimatization, civic renewal, responsibility, penal reform, mental health rehabilitation. It's not good enough anymore to say, I don't do that, I do this one box. What you're trying to do is explain human behaviour in the round. You're trying to address these challenges. The technologies are there, but even if you deploy them, they're not being used properly because there's a human factor that gets in the way. And what I think is really exciting is, in some of the great universities around the world, you have this unified social science where you're putting people who do rehabilitation engineering in touch with people who do psychology, and they're coming up with usable programs. You mentioned a colleague in Rush, whether it's low tech or high tech, it's this idea that a human interface makes a technology embed itself more easily. And what has happened now is this breakdown between I only do this kind of problem with this one method. In a way, society said that's no longer good enough anymore. It's very hard to just keep that show on the road when we have so much around us that we just need to be able to click ideas and methods and technologies into the right format to get them working.
You sound to me, you sound to me like a walking advert for that way of behaving, really. And I mean, and I'm referring now to the fact that, you know, you're straddling both Trinity and UCD, which always in my head used to be kind of implicit competitors, etc., you know. And there'd be rivalry, and surely there is rivalry, and long should there be rivalry, yes. I'd have thought, between seats of learning. But the point is that I want to ask you one last question because we're running out of time here.
And he needs to eat his pizza.
And I need, but he can always eat, Jonathan. But anyway, academic culture in Ireland. I've been out of Ireland for 30 years, right? And I speak as a kind of researcher when I ask this question, really. I mean, are you a lone voice, or would you honestly say that, I presume that there's still a minority of academics who behave like you.
I think it's a large minority. I think it's not just grains of sand.
Have you got to a tipping point, would you say?
We're getting there. I think we're getting there in terms of how, first thing to bear in mind is academia was the world's first global industry in terms of people. It always had people movement going around it that weren't bonded slaves, that were, whether if you look at Schrodinger coming to Dublin in the 40s on De Valera's request, it was always a global industry, and that's fascinating. The second thing I think is really helpful to understand about it is the ones who you want to work with, you find them very easily. There's a self-selection involved. If you're open, you will find other open people. If you wanted to stay and work with your laptop by yourself or just in the library.
Do you
yourself.
Use social media at
yeah,
all?
I do, yeah. I use it quite a lot for academic purposes.
What do you use?
Twitter and LinkedIn. And I'm beginning to use Skype and things like Google Hangout for working with colleagues who are in different places, which saves time, money, effort. With these technologies at your fingertips, you don't need these teleconference facilities. You don't need to travel twice a year to Holland. It's changed.
It's changed, and that's the end of our...